Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books. We're joined, of course, by little Alfred. There he is.
Good Lord.
PJ, it's episode 16. Sweet 16, and we will not comment on our kissing status, as the proverbial slang goes. PJ, how are you?
Yeah, very well. I'm in Ireland now, so we're in the same country, but I'm in a very far and secluded forest. Well, not as secluded. So I'm near Galway.
You've gone very far south, we're going to do a pilgrimage. There's going to be a little pilgrimage, and I'm going to come visit you in the next 2 weeks. So
you are with our mutual friends.
A mutual friend, Ryan. Playboy Alex. We're gonna. I don't think he likes that name. We're gonna come down and visit you. So we'll have a little Books Boys excursion. Get some clips from the journey on Instagram. PJ, I think we've done a lot of reading this month, so I feel like we should just get stuck in.
Let's get to it. I'm still confused what they are. I've been reading toilet scrolls, trying to decipher the meaning of. Trying to decipher meaning of Harry Potter and the Odyssey and.
Peter, I have this one, and it has like it looks like a book, right? It's got covers, it's got papers, it's got lines in, and then it says, you know, Monday the 24th of January, Tuesday the 25th of January, and there's some spaces. Is this books?
It's a postmodern work on the meaningness of mankind after the Berlin Wall. It's quite a classic.
Yeah, it's called 2022, the postmodern classic. So
yeah, there you go, guys. So get it, buy it.
Get it, buy it, books. Oh, you said the catchphrase.
I took it away from you. All right, guys. So let's get to it.
I'll go first.
Can I put on my Irish accent?
No, you've not been there long enough to pick that up.
Okay. Sorry, guys. Sorry. I'm half Irish.
He's half Irish, so you don't not allowed to be offended.
Half allowed to do that stuff. All right.
Okay. The first book I read, George Eliot, Middlemarch.
I thought you wouldn't finish that book until the middle of March, the way you were talking about it.
Oh, gosh. It took me in the end 2.5 weeks, but I thought it was going to take me the whole month. Like, it felt like 3 months had gone past. I was thinking like, oh my God, I'm going to have nothing to talk about on the show because I'm struggling to get through this one book. Now, to be fair, look, it is 800 pages. It is a long book.
It is considered one of the best books of man and womankind, you know.
I am shocked by this because it's not bad by any means. It's not bad, I should stress. But it's also not brilliant. I mean, Silas Marner was better. I give Silas Marner a glowing review. George Eliot has written good books. The Mill and the Floss, well, the less said, the better. But Silas Marner was very good, you know? And this felt like it just didn't need to be 800 pages. Maybe you could have cut it into like a third of that amount, and it would have been a nice little novel. But let me tell you about Middlemarch. Middlemarch is a crazy town where everyone is obsessed with doctors. Okay, that's my main takeaway from this book. My main takeaway is it's a small village. Like, they're all living in these Victorian little towns. And there's like four different doctors, and everybody's really concerned about like who your doctor is and how much business the local doctor's getting. And there's not enough business to go around, so let's be very concerned about which doctor you go to when you get ill. Like, but they've got nothing else going on. They're very, very concerned about the medical man. And there's a banker, Bill Stroud, and he's gonna get a hospital built. And it's all very like, which doctors are going to be running the hospital? Is it the physicians or is it the more general practitioner kind? It's a strange concern for the average man, you know? It's just, bizarre.
These were Victorian times then, you know? These are desperate times, you know? Where, you know.
Well, yeah, when you're having a medical emergency on a weekly basis, then I guess it does matter. So we get a good insight.
It's supposed to be a great example of realism. So I think literally, instead of talking about cowboys and what have you not, they talk about the average problem of mankind, probably where you're going to get your next leg operation for or whatever it was.
My other problem with it is it just has too many stories that eventually intersect, and everyone's got similar names like Lewick and Lydgate and Bulstrode and all these names that are very similar to other names, and it gets a bit confusing. But you know, the good thing is it gives us a lot of interesting Ladislaw and Lewick and Lydgate. I mean, come on. But it gives us an interesting insight into family life. We actually see a lot of couples, and we see some really lovely, caring, you know, lovely couples that are so good to each other. And then we see, like, you know, ones that aren't. And that's the bit that I enjoyed the most. But I'm going to tell you my absolute favorite bit, because it's going to lead into our sponsor, PJ. I've been working on a business enterprise for us this week. So there's a nice bit near the beginning where they play the slang versus poetry card game. So you will say anything, mercy. Fred, to gain your point. Well, tell me whether it is slang or poetry to call you a leg platter. Of course, you can call it poetry if you like. Ah, Miss Rosie, you don't know Homer from slang. I shall invent a new game. I shall write bits of slang and poetry on slips and give them to you to separate. And so, dear me, how amusing it is to hear you young people talk. So this is what the youths are working on, PJ. They're separating slang from poetry on little slips of paper. So
tell Monopoly to, you know, go into some other kind of business, like fight chips, because this game is going to hit the town very soon.
It is. Guys, slang versus poetry, the card game, .gov, and you can get that. That's our sponsor for this month's episode. I need to play that. I really do. But look, we get some similar vibes to the Mill on the Floss, you know, the little family life, and it's a bit depressing at times. Just the usual that you would expect. But we also get some nice things. There's a girl, Mary, and there's a chap, Fred, and they're in love, and it's very nice, and she's not a coquette, but she tries to put him off a lot and play hard to get a little bit, whilst being very virtuous and very lovely. And actually, her family know that she loves him, and they know that he loves her, and her parents kind of try to help out, and the dad gets Fred a job and everything. It's all very nice, you know. But Fred was expecting to inherit a lot of money from Mr. Featherstone, from some old guy, and he doesn't inherit the money. And Mary feels very bad, because as the guy was dying, he says to her, there's two wills, will you please destroy one? And she says, I'm not meddling in this in case I get in trouble. And of course, had she destroyed the will, her fiancé would have inherited £10,000. So, you know, she feels bad that she caused that. So that's why they help him out to get a job and things like that. So all the usual goings on. Slang versus poetry and ripping up wills. Just your day-to-day life with about four doctors competing for your affections. Just the normal goings on in Victorian England.
That's it.
There's also this chap. So there's this guy. We open the book with two sisters, Kitty and Dolly. I know that maybe sounds a little bit Tolstoyan there, but
Dolly.
We have Dolly is Dorothea, okay, and she marries a Mr. Casaubon, who is much, much, much older than her and treats her like crap. He doesn't want a wife. He wants a secretary that he doesn't have to pay. So he does a lot of scholarly pursuits, and he just gets her to like mark down his notes, essentially. That's her life as a wife. And he'll wake her up at like 3 a.m. and be like, I think it's time we mark down some notes. And she just got to write down some thoughts for him. And even on their honeymoon, he, you know, leaves her all day while he goes, like, you know, excavating texts or whatever. And he has a young nephew called Will Ladislaw, And Will forms a bit of a connection with Dorothea, so Will has to go and he's not allowed back to the house anymore. And when he dies, he actually writes it into the will that his wife will inherit everything as long as she never marries his nephew. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's the tremendous love story that she wants to marry him anyway and forsake all her riches and all this kind of thing. So there's some romance, and I do like the romance, and it is a good book. It's just a very, very long book, and there's lots of subplots. So we have Lydgate and his wife, Rosamund. And Rosamund doesn't really like him. She's the coquette. And she's like, you know, Lydgate, I would never have married you if I thought our life was going to be difficult or I thought we were going to be poor. And Lydgate's trying to be a good doctor and not just give people prescriptions they don't need. So because of that, he's not making as much money as the other doctors. So that's why she's saying, I would never have known that. Just do what they're all doing and we'll have more money. And he says, well, we're going to have to sell our fancy plates and cutlery that we bought. And maybe some of your jewelry. And she's outraged. I shall go back to mama and papa because I never thought my husband would make me sell my plates. And she's just outraged by this. And I would never have married you if I'd known we would have to have, you know, not a full set of plates. And she's very, you know, very stuck up. And then she's pregnant. And he tries to be a good doctor and like look after her and tell her to look after the baby. And she's off flirting with other men. And she like goes horse riding with one of them. And she falls off the horse and she loses the baby. And
I think that's a famous scene, isn't it?
Yeah. She's not distraught at all. She's just like, yeah, whatever, who cares, next. And he's distraught, obviously. And she's just really immature, you know. And then when he tries to like bring it up, she's just like, well, I wish I'd died with the baby. And she's just like very emotionally manipulative and making him always feel bad, you know.
It doesn't seem like a very feminist novel coming from a woman.
In some ways, it's not. But Dorothea, although she begins not very feminist, she marries this guy who's not really that. He doesn't abuse her. He's just not a loving husband. With a scholarly one, she becomes a stronger character later in the book, and Mary's very strong with her love Fred because she keeps putting him off and says, "And I'm not going to marry you if you go into the clergy. I'm not going to marry you if you do something silly. You've got to get yourself straight, get yourself in order." You know. So some of the women are strong. But it is sad to see the likes of this one, Rosie, who's very much the coquette and very much, you know, I'm just going to complain to my husband that he's not good enough all the time. And, you know, I wish I'd died with the baby and all this kind of stuff. And she doesn't care about the fact that they're struggling financially, about his emotional needs. She's just very much, well, what's in it for me? Constantly, you know.
Okay.
So we get to see good couples and bad couples, you know, and we see some that are so, so in love. That treat each other so well and always bigging each other up and always complimenting each other and respecting each other. So the parents of Mary are always respecting each other's wisdom and that, you know, just really, really good, strong bonds with people who are really in love. And then we also see the reverse. And I guess in a sense that is realist, you know, we get to see the good and the bad side of relationships in this novel.
Yes. That's the whole point of the novel is to show, to show a glimpse of society at the time. Yeah. So that's the whole point about realism.
Here's our mill on the floss type stuff. There's a scene where Dorothea and Mr. Casaubon have argued. Well, they've not argued. She had tried to assert her own will. And he says, you know, Dorothea, you're trying to use your own intelligence, but I would rather that you just obey me, you know. And she feels so bad that she's upset him that she waits outside his room all the night in case he leaves to like get a glass of water or something. And then he wakes up in the night, you know, and sees, it's like the scene with the girl sitting beside her dad's knee.
Hoping to have some affection.
Yeah. And eventually he says, you know, were you waiting all night for me? And he says, yes, I did not like to disturb you, you know, and she just waits. And that's supposed to be a happy moment. But I didn't find that level of submission to really be happy, you know.
Oh, my God. Okay. Good Lord.
Yeah, it's a little bit... It's got the goods and the bads, you know, but look, it's difficult to get with 800 pages and about four different families all intersecting. I mean, a lot of the plots don't really tie together and then near the end they do. It's difficult to give a synopsis, you know. There is a bad chap called Raffles and Raffles knows some secrets about people. There's some bad blood in Will Ladislaw. He's not as pure as they thought. And he knows the banker Bulstrode was maybe made some of his money through some dodgy means. So we get some tense scenes with, you know, is this guy going to let everyone in on our secrets and do we need to bribe him? And he's a bit of a Dickens character, Raffles. You know, he's a bit of a slimy Dickensian type character. So we get to see...
might be a bit amusing to read it.
I think he's there for a little bit of not even comic relief, but just it's something different because all the other people are kind of the same, you know?
Okay. Well, let me tell you about the book I read, Dean. What I read was a bit different to A Men of March. It's called O Monte Cinco by Paulo Coelho, The Fifth Mountain. Have you ever read some Paulo Coelho?
I honestly, no, I haven't.
So Paulo Coelho is a Brazilian author who's famous for the book The Alchemist, which came out in the late 80s. And he's one of these novelists that are also kind of, let's say, they're very much, they write self-help books in the form of a novel, or even spiritual books, you may call them. And now The Alchemist is a beautiful novel about a man searching for treasure in Egypt because he had a dream, but really it's about self-discovery. And all the books are about self-discovery, really. So this book takes a story from the Bible about the prophet Elijah.
Okay.
From Kings in the Bible. And it's basically about Elijah's kind of early life before he became a leading prophet. So he was born a prophet in the sense of he heard angels, but the parents didn't want him to hear angels. So they said, don't tell anyone, because supposedly if you could hear angels, you would then be a prophet and then be part of the government. And they didn't want that. But at some point, the angel... I think he has an angel, a constant angel, but then he has an angel of God visiting him at one point. He's working as a carpenter. And he says, tell the queen at the time of Israel, who was not Christian, but worshipped a pagan religion that we now call it. And this angel says to Elijah, tell her that this religion is not true, that the only one true is Christianity. And that if you don't submit to Christianity, this country will have no rain and no crops and everything will slowly die. So he tells her this, but she doesn't want to believe it. And she threatens she commands every prophet in Israel to be killed. So basically, Elijah already feels guilty. He's hiding away at the beginning of the novel, already feels guilty that almost all prophets of Israel have been killed because basically he said something like that. And the whole novel really is about him kind of doubting himself, mainly. Now, he does believe that there is God because he's here, the angel. And yet he doesn't necessarily believe God is benevolent, first of all. And he definitely doesn't believe that he is capable of being a prophet, even though he's being sent. So he has to leave the country. He's being fed by crows in the middle of nature and then is being sent to the city of Akbar. Was this outside of Israel, where their religion is one of the queen. That's not Christianity. Mm. Yet he's supposed to go there. He's just supposed to go there and wait for further instruction to come back to Israel and save Israel from damnation. So I know it may sound very religious and maybe even I might put you off if you're not very religious, but to be honest, the book is not at all, I would say, a religious book. It's not about Christianity per se. It's about the story of him not believing in himself and putting up with a lot of challenges. Basically, he does become accepted by the town of Akbar because they believe they can't, they shouldn't kill anyone. They have to take anyone in as guests. And the people do start to like him, but because of him, let's say, terrible things happen and a lot of people die accidentally. And he again thinks it's his own fault, and he keeps following the voices from his angels, and they seem sometimes a bit they don't seem to make sense sometimes, in the sense they seem to be damaging other people. And the fifth mountain is basically the mountain that these people think where the gods live, but Elijah knows there are no gods, there's just one God.
Yeah.
And there's just always this kind of dilemma of what he believes, what the others believe, and he falls in love with the woman who takes him up and allows him to live in her house, and she's a widow. But he's also torn between, you know, succumbing to the love of a woman and being a prophet. But the interesting thing is, God actually says in the book, that's why I don't think Paulo Coelho is necessarily liked by all Christians, because it's very kind of a different Christianity. God says, you know, no man has lived properly until he has made love to his woman. And that's an interesting thing. There is a bit of a hippie element to the whole thing. Yet the person of Elijah, he's still kind of living this sort of more of a lot more repressed Christian personality that we think is Christianity.
Yeah,
Paulo Coelho always makes the point that the true God is actually not quite the church God. So I think, I'm not sure what Paulo Coelho is, but he always feels like a Catholic who's also a hippie and is also, you know, he's also meditated on Buddha. So it's a very interesting kind of spiritual mix. But I just find the story amazing. It is an adventure story in the end. I won't tell what happens more, but you don't have to look into the deeper meanings, which is about self-belief in the end, self-love, not about Christianity. But you can also just take that away, and in the end, it's just a great adventure novel, quite horrifying sometimes with all the death, but also there was plenty of love. And I find the description great of these deserts and the fifth mountain where he has to climb at one point. And I think it's a great novel. Really recommend. It's Paulo Coelho. Check it out if you haven't already. The Alchemist, The Fifth Mountain.
Okay, sounds very good. Sounds something different than maybe we would normally read. But it sounds very good.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I always like Coelho. His books often help me in times of change. And I was just reading this when I was just moving here to Ireland. So I'm in Ireland, guys, now since a few weeks. And just helped me. It was just a New Year's kind of book, and it just suited the vibe. Really recommend it, guys.
Cool. Well, before I get to my next book, I'll just mention, first of all, that if you want more, you can get it at patreon.com/booksboys. We are doing so much content. So you get this show early. You can get a Books Boys t-shirt. You can recommend books for us to read, depending on the level of your donation. But even at the most minimal level, you're getting all the bonus content. So this month, myself and Alex, we did a Playboys episode, and we did a full hour reviewing Shakespeare's A Winter's Tale. That is on the A-level syllabus. We're working our way through the A-level ones. They're kind of semi-review, semi-study guide. So we did A Winter's Tale. Also with Robert, the third episode of Dark Place Dreamers, all about Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, is out. We did Skipper the Eye Child, and Robert thought it was absolute nonsense, and I thought it was brilliant. So it's more about getting his reaction to a crazy TV show with Matt Berry and Richard Ayoade and some of your favorites. And also another interview from the vault with the amazing singer-songwriter Kim Edwards that I did a decade ago, and I've re-released that on there as well. So you're basically getting a minimum of something every week, actually, on there. I mean, December we put loads up, but usually you're getting a few extra shows per month on there for the price of a cup of coffee. So £2.50, $3. So I recommend checking that out.
And there's many more to come, including a special, which might include a bit more than just two people. So
yeah, we have something already in the works for this month. So hopefully people will enjoy that. Guys, the next book I read, look, you told me to try some Irish literature. And I remember on episode 4, Ciarán specifically recommended Iris Murdoch. So I saw this one in the Magic Bookshop, where I went again this month, by the way. And I got Bruno's Dream. Now,
right.
I didn't love it, PJ. I didn't love it. I'm sorry. Again, similar to Middlemarch, it was all right. You know, I didn't dislike it. But I didn't really love it. And as we talked about this, you know, off air, it has a weird obsession with sexual themes, you know, for the character's sake, for no real reason, you know. And that is something that struck me as unusual. But it also strikes me as unusual that all the characters have the same sexual obsessions. So I kind of put it down to poor writing, but all the male characters, bar one, are the same. And they have the same perversions, and they have the same, they're all womanizers, and, you know, they all want to sleep with everyone and cheat on everyone and whatever else. And they all even use the same phrase. They never say, can I sleep with you, or can we have sex? It's always, can you come to bed with me? Like, that's that exact phrase, but like four different guys are saying it. And I'm like, there's a little bit of lack of awareness there that four people are using like the exact same phrase and they're all doing the same thing. And I just feel like it's a little bit, I don't know. I just feel like something's lacking from like good character development. I want to see the different characters behave differently, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, Iris Murdoch, she did study, she taught and studied and wrote about philosophy and Sartre being one of them, you know, and Sartre was the whole hell is other people philosophy. I feel like when I read her book, yes, the characters sometimes are very alike, but I think that's the point. I think the point is she's making a feminist jab at saying that you men are doing all the same thing the whole time. You're saying the same thing. Even if you sugarcoat it, would say, would you like to go to bed and give me instead of would you like to F me? I think she's making a point that it's all very repetitive, I find.
The women characters aren't any better, though. That's the thing.
Mm. Yeah, and that totally is. I agree with you. There is a lot of what's the word? It's a lot about sex, her books, like a lot. And also about, I suppose, also a lot about just kind of broken characters, aren't there? They're often very broken characters trying to connect, I suppose. They're not really managing 100%.
So the main character in this one's Bruno. He's kind of an old dying man. He's almost entirely bedridden. They say at the moment he can still get up to use the toilet and things, but he's more or less bedridden. You know, his skin's all sagging away. He's just faded away. They talk about this like shriveled monstrous body with this big head, because I guess his head's still normal, you know. And he's essentially just fading into away to nothing. And he's living with Danby, and Danby's a kind of nephew, I guess. And although Danby seems to not really be good to anyone else in the novel, he is good to Bruno. Like, he takes Bruno in and he looks after him, and he's very happy to do so, you know? And he gets a carer, Nigel, who's like a male nurse kind of chap who's into all this Zen type stuff. I'll get to Nigel in a minute. But they bring him in to look after Bruno, and that goes quite well. And Bruno has his stamp collection that's worth a lot of money. But it's never clear that Danby's trying to get the stamp collection, to be honest. He doesn't seem to have ulterior motives. He seems to just want to be nice to his relative, you know? Mm-hmm. So you like Danby. And there's a girl living with him, Adelaide, who was hired as a kind of maid, as a housekeeper type character. And of course, Danby's sleeping with her, but they have this relationship, but he is also still paying her a wage. And it's a secret relationship, but she doesn't do any housekeeping, really. And there's this kind of, okay, she feels that her position's not stable because she's essentially a paid mistress and he could just fire her if he wanted to. She's not his girlfriend. She's not his wife, you know? So she worries, which is fine because actually she's already got backups because she knows these two twins, Nigel, who is the carer, and his brother, Will. And she fancies Will. Well, actually, she's in love with both of them as well as Danby, but she's mostly in love with Will. And she keeps stringing Will along. She's not sleeping with Will, but she's stringing him along, having a kind of emotional affair. He keeps thinking that there's a chance. But Will's horrible. Will's awful. He calls her names. He threatens to hit her. He tells her to steal one of the stamps so he can buy a camera. You know, tries to get her in trouble. He's just not a nice chap. And then we've got, you know, Miles. Now, this chap, Miles, is Bruno's son. They've not seen each other for many, many years. But Bruno says, before I die, I would like to see my son. So Danby writes to Miles. And look, everybody, Miles, Danby, Bruno, they all talk about their past loves and how they mistreated all these previous women and how they got it wrong with these different women. And then now we have them all trying to repeat their own mistakes because everyone wants to have an affair with everyone else's woman. So Adelaide's, you know, going to cheat on Danby with Will. Danby seduces Miles' wife, Deanna. Deanna realizes... Well,
don't get too many spoilers, dude.
We're not going to the end. We're not going to the end. This is the middle. Diana, this is important. Diana introduces her sister Lisa into the household, but then her husband Miles falls in love with Lisa. So we've just got like these overlapping Venn diagram love triangle things everywhere. And all the characters are more or less the same. And, you know, at one point there's even a duel, like it's Dumas, you know. But I'm not going to give anything about really the last quarter or about like what happens at the end. I didn't love it. I didn't love the ending. I didn't think that the book was particularly well written. There's just a lot of people who fall in love very, very quickly because a guy was a bit smarmy. So they, you know, and everyone's just, we're very willing to cheat. There's not really any moral scruples in it. And then we have Nigel. And Nigel's just very strange. And they have these types of conversations. You know, the world is independent of my will. The sense of it must lie outside of it. And in the world, everything is as it is, and happiness and happens as it does happen. In it, there is no value. And if there were, it would be of no value. And if good and bad willing changes the world, it can only change the limits of the world. Nigel just speaks like a weird philosophy textbook, you know. And they wonder, like, what's happening with Nigel? He's doing a lot of drugs. What's his vibe, you know? And then there's some weird stuff with the relationship between Nigel and Will as well. And there's just a lot of... The characters react strangely to each other. It does get better as it goes along, to be honest, because we get some very ridiculous scenes where people's love drives them to do ridiculous things in an almost Flaubertian kind of way. And it does pick up a little bit. And I wasn't sure if I loved the ending as such, but, you know, it's fine. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, because I find a lot of the, it's very sexual. A lot of the characters are a bit one dimensional, but also very similar, you know? So okay. It was fine, but I wouldn't read it again.
Okay. Well, I would recommend that you read The Sandcastle if you want to have one more go, or The Italian Girl. I haven't read this one you read, Bruno's Dream, but I find her books tend to be very, in some sense, my dad would say this, that they're not very memorable, but you're left with an impression, an atmosphere, and certain scenes. Like there is in Sandcastle, there is a scene where two kids kind of slit the, it's quite brutal actually, they slit the very bottom of their eye.
Oh, goodness.
So they can cry blood. I mean, it's quite brutal, in fact. And then an Italian Girl, there's like, you just remember that there are two kind of lovers. One of them eats a lot of vegetables, one of them a lot of fruits, but you're supposed to be brothers. You're left with these impressions. And I find it's always very, yeah, it is always very overly sexual, but it's also very brutal. And it just shows how animal, you know, how animal humans are. That's what I like about it. Personally. Okay. So I'm sure it should be mentioned again at some point this year. So
could be. I read three more books, but I'm going to be honest, I'm really only going to do a review of one of them. I'm just going to quickly mention what the other two were. Okay, so the first one, because these two didn't make a great impression on me either, but the last one I loved, so I'm saving the best for last. I read by Apollonius Rhodius, or Apollonius of Rhodes, The Argonautica. So that's the story of Jason and the Argonauts. This was pretty quick. It was 200 pages. I'll be honest. After the length of time that Middlemarch took me, I was trying to read short books to fit some in. No more 500-600 pages. It was like, okay, I've got to read 200-page books here. You know, so Bruno's Dream was only like 300 pages and pretty short. This was 200. I mean, this is a nice translation. It's got the Greek and the English.
Oh, lovely. I love that.
It's lovely. Yeah, it's from the Maclay Library. Look, this has, it's written a little bit later than the kind of classical Greek period that I usually go in for. It's a story of Jason and the Argonauts. You know, Medea is in there. Jason's trying to get the golden fleece, and he goes on his little quest. And in the end, with the goddess, it's actually easier than fighting her than to just kind of do some tasks and then convince her to marry him, so that it kind of ends nicely for him. But we've got other characters. You know, Hercules is in there at one point near the beginning. But the first half is honestly just them doing their odes and their preparation and going to the Oracle and kind of getting all ready. And then the second half, some stuff actually happens. And look, you know what happens when you read this Greek stuff, like it can be kind of boring in parts, you know, but it's just that basic story. He gets the fleece, it's all happy. But we have some similar themes from the Odyssey. Like they mention the Cyclops, they mention Scylla and Charybdis, the two kind of sea monsters. So some, a little bit of rehashing old themes as well in there, you know. But yeah, look, it's fine if you're interested in that kind of thing. I think I've got three books in a row where I would say, if you think you like that kind of thing, maybe try it, but I wouldn't especially recommend them, you know.
Okay.
And the same, I think, is going to be said for the next one. I didn't tell you I'd read this one, La Hojarasca by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
All right, okay, no, you haven't.
You know this one?
No, I haven't read that one. Is that, I think that's one of the earlier ones, what? Right?
Yeah. Look, it's early. It's, I think the reason this book is remembered is because it has one character, a colonel or something. One character, and also the same town as one of the famous ones, I believe, 100 Years of Solitude.
Indeed, so. It's Macondo. So that's the town of 100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah.
The creation. Oh my God, well, I would love to read that.
This is a very short book. We're talking, it's less than 200 pages and with big text. Like, I feel like this is about 120 pages. Like, it's very short, you know? I did like it, but at the same time, I didn't love it. And I find it difficult to get into. And I have a problem with these Latin American authors, which is that they never put enough dialogue in their books. And I really, really struggle to read a book that is just narrative without character work and dialogue. And it's the usual, it's set through multiple generations. So I get a bit confused going back and forward. You know, the book opens with the doctor dying. Well, he's already dead. And that's kind of a powerful scene. But then, of course, that really takes place later. And I don't know. Look, I don't really have a lot to say about it because it is a very quick book and I don't want to spoil anything because then you've spoiled the whole book, really. Like, there's not a lot happens in it just because of its short length. But if you've liked 100 Years of Solitude, for example, then you might want to dip into something kind of set in the same world, if it were, you know?
Wow. Okay, well, I love 100 Years of Solitude. And I think you will love it too, despite the fact that it doesn't have much dialogue. Most Latin American novels, they do tend to describe generational storytelling, generation storytelling mode. And 100 Years of Solitude probably has even less dialogue.
Oh, I struggle with that, you know. And I feel it makes me feel bad because I'm trying to read in Spanish and then I'm thinking I'm not enjoying this. And I always think my Spanish isn't on point. But no, when I read I can read 1,000 pages of fun, you know. And even when I was reading H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds last month in English, that was 200 pages and I struggled to get through it because of the lack of dialogue. So, it's not a language thing. It is just I like characters and dialogue in my books. And I do struggle to get through a book that doesn't really have a lot of dialogue. And even when I'm reading it, I'm not taking in what's happening. This one's fine. We've got the different generations. You know, there's some bad parts where the girl's forced to marry a guy that she doesn't really, she's never met. Not that she doesn't love him. She's never met him. And just all the usual kind of stuff. But I didn't love it, you know?
Well, okay. Well, I'd love to read that one. But guys, if you want to get some backdrop for 100 Years of Solitude, Leaf Storm or La Hojarasca.
Leaf Storm, yeah.
Is the book.
Honestly, I think that is the main reason anyone would read this book. It's going to be someone who already liked 100 Years of Solitude and they want to kind of dip into a little bit extra in the same kind of universe.
I'd say so.
This book I loved. Now, we laughed about this during the month, PJ. Oh, yeah. I read... it's presented here now, you see it. The Son of Porthos by Alexandre Dumas.
There you go. Himself, or is it?
Well, you open the book and it has a biographical note on Dumas. And it gives me a lot of information about Alexandre Dumas and a picture of Alexandre Dumas.
Oh.
And in the book, on at least two occasions, he mentions our previous work, The Man in the Iron Mask. So the author is saying, I'm Dumas, and this is what happened in the previous book I wrote. But this book was written 12 years after Dumas died. So this is not by Dumas.
Are you sure he just didn't live a long time? What about Alexandre Dumas Jr.? I mean, he was around,
well,
wasn't he?
It could be, but this book is believed to not be canon, to not be by Dumas, to be just by a completely random guy. And I looked up to see what else this guy wrote, and he wrote a whole bunch of stuff, none of it I'd ever heard of, including one book. It was like The Countess of Monte Cristo or something like that. He'd written like a female version of The Count of Monte Cristo. So I thought that was very funny. But
I bet you're going to look out for more of his books.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So what's the guy called?
Oh, goodness. He's kind of a no-name. I didn't even bother to write down his name. It doesn't even say it in the book. Like, when you read the book, it doesn't even say...
But you enjoyed the book, though.
So, oh, I loved the book. It's the best book I read this month. But let me get the name of the chap for you. Believed to have been written by Paul Mahalan.
Well, tell George Eliot to move aside because we've got a new kid in town, right?
Everyone's favorite well-known author, Paul Mahalan. So, look, this book does not have the Three Musketeers, right? Or D'Artagnan. D'Artagnan's not in it. I'm not going to tell people why. I don't want to spoil things from any of the other books, but Jotaidin's not in it. Athos isn't in it. And Porthos isn't in it. The only one who's in it is Aramis. And Aramis is a very old man. And Aramis has kind of changed in character a little bit. I mean, he was always the sneakiest of the musketeers, but now he's basically the bad guy. Okay? Yeah. So he's plotting. He wants to, you know, he's already like high priest of the Jesuits. He wants to become Pope. He's got a lot of political power. He's moved from France to Spain. He wants to do some maneuvering to get control of the French throne now. And he's also going to use Porthos' son as part of that whole thing. But of course, he doesn't know it's Porthos' son, okay? So the son of Porthos is this random guy called Joel. And Joel never knew who his dad was, but Joel's a big old guy because Porthos was the big, strong, giant musketeer. And he finds this sword in the spot where Porthos died. Somehow, this like image of his dad gives him the sword, you know? And it's a massive sword, and on the sword it says, all for one and one for all, engraved on the sword. Which is, of course, the slogan of the Musketeers, which is actually only ever said once in the whole series of five books.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's
really?
In the very first book. It's the only time they ever say it. until now, it's on the sword. So that's cool, right? And, you know, he meets but I love the romance, man. I love the romance. He meets this lovely girl, Aurora. And, he's valiant. So he sees some guys heckling this girl and he jumps in and he's going to save the day and he's going to brandish his sword and he chases away the bad guys and they're stealing money from people and he comes in and saves the day. He's very valiant. And this is one of these books where everyone's challenging people to duels left, right, and center. And, you know, if you say something bad in the presence of a woman, then, you know, I'm going to lay down my gauntlet and we're going to have a duel and we're all going to die. And I love it. I love the romance of these books.
Like that, yeah.
And it's very short as well. It's like 200 pages. I think it's very, very short, but maybe 300 at a push. But it's the best book I read this month. Like, I loved it. Aramis's scheming took me a little bit by surprise because I think that he's not quite there in the Three Musketeers. But then again, a lot of years are supposed to have passed. So maybe he's gotten worse, you know, he's taken his worst trait and he's gotten worse and worse, you know, as time has gone on. And I guess that's something that could happen. But I love the swashbuckling. I do like that we get to see Porthos' son. And I don't want to give I don't want to really give spoilers for the ending, but throughout most of the book, Aramis and Joel don't know who each other is.
And does he, because we did talk about Alice Automated by Jeff Noon, where he basically pretends to write he writes a sequel to the two original Alice books, and he did imitate the star very well in the first half up to the point that it became less of an Alice story. Did this author also imitate the Dumas senior style very well,
or yes,
did you feel that
yes, excellently. You would think this was really Dumas. Like, it's believably by Dumas. Yeah, it's very, very well done.
That's impressive.
My only criticism is that it rushes a lot near the end. Like, Dumas' books would typically be longer than this. And this book starts out quite slow in the usual way. Slow but exciting. Dumas is a master of that. But then just kind of near the end, it just, like, all rushes. And it's like, you know, okay, everything's got to wrap up in the next 50 pages. Like, I don't know why it kind of gets so quick, you know? But look, it's lovely. You don't get to see too many of the characters you know, but I mean, look at the kind of romantic scenes where Joel, this girl he's only met like 2 days ago, and he's saying, you know, that he would lay down his life for her and shed all the blood in his body to protect her, and she's in love with him. And there's a nice scene where there's going to be a wedding, so they put Joel in jail. That becomes very reminiscent of the Count of Monte Cristo at that point, and he doesn't know that he's getting let out, so they take him to a wedding. Because they want to use him as a pawn in their political game, but he thinks he's been taken to his execution. So there's nice comic scenes where he's saying, like, I know the last meal is supposed to be kind of fancy, but, like, I'm in a palace. Like, where have they taken me? And And they're always talking at cross purposes, where he's like, "Oh, the big day's here," and they mean the wedding, and he means that, you know, that he's being killed.
Oh, right, okay.
I'm losing my freedom, and they're like, "Yeah."
Sounds very Woodhouse-ian again.
There's a bit of that, yeah. And they're kind of speaking, because, you know, this old-fashioned sexist idea that when you get married, you kind of lose your freedom and you're, you know, so they're saying that kind of stuff, but he thinks it's about him dying, you know, so that's quite funny. Yeah. That's quite funny.
Wow, I'd love to read it. Right, and what's the book called again?
The Son of Porthos. My favorite bit from the whole book, someone says, "And what might your name be?" And he says, "I'm not sure what it might be, but it is Joel." I love that. I don't know why. I don't know why I love that so much, but it's hilarious.
Is that a phrase you're going to start using? I think so, right?
I think so. There's a lovely little chap called Friquet, who's a kind of, I guess they describe him as like a kind of dwarf, essentially. Like, he's a very short person, but he's high up. He's in the military and things. Like, he's an important person, but he's very, very hot-headed because people are always making fun of his height. And when they meet in the tavern and he wants some food and Porthos wants to share his food, and they have a duel and they're going to fight, and the landlord's in on the duel and the barman's in on the duel, and they're all going to have a big fight, and then they all become best friends, and now they're friends for life, and they love each other platonically, and they help each other out in the army later on. Like, I just love the bonds that these people form over a duel or over meeting in one day, you know, that romance. It's amazing, and this is written very, very excellently, exactly like the Dumas, the whole series of Dumas books. So if you've read the five, you know, Three Musketeers series, and you just thought it would be lovely if there was a little bit more, then this is essentially a very early example of fan fiction, and that is just perfect.
I think it would be interesting also to now check out Alexandre Dumas Jr.'s book, because, I mean, I'm just wondering if there's anything. You know,
yeah, I don't know a lot about Junior, to be perfectly honest.
But he is an author, and he was an author, and I do see his books from time to time, especially in secondhand bookshops in the French section. So at least in the original French, it's relatively popular, so I think.
Okay. I've never tried it, to be honest. I loved him. I mean, this is risky business, but I would maybe put Dumas almost on, like, if Dickens is 100%, Dumas is like 99%. Like, it's really, I think that Dumas is a very, very special author. The only reason I can't quite tie him with Dickens is because I've read all of Dickens, and I've really only read a certain amount of Dumas, so it wouldn't be fair. Like, he could have a couple of terrible books in there, for all I know, and that's the problem, you know?
Mm. Well, we'll see then when you've read them. I'm sure you will.
Well, no, I will. I've got one on my shelf to go to, but...
Well, let me tell you what I read. I also read, after The Fifth Mountain, I read the first two plays of the Dublin Trilogy by Sean O'Casey. So Sean O'Casey being a big man for Ireland becoming Ireland. So written, so he's basically a self-taught, kind of a politician kind of figure, but he just started writing plays. He wasn't really educated, but he started writing plays around the Easter Rising time of Ireland, when Ireland started to want to become independent and want to not be a British satellite state, basically.
Yeah.
Or under British rule. And he writes the Dublin Trilogy, which is very much celebrated in, at least in the Republic of Ireland. And it consists of three plays. And so I've read the first two. The first one is The Shadow of a Gunman, followed by Juno and the Paycock. And the third one is The Plug and the Stars. And the last two particularly are often at the Abbey Theatre played in Irish theatres. Now, The Shadow of a Gunman is a great story, slightly, I would say, easier to produce than the other two. It's basically set around the Civil War period, but they're not soldiers. It's just a poet living with another man, basically. He doesn't really do anything particular, tries to just earn money. And there's a lot of the Irish War is kind of behind the scenes, so it's all set in one of the man's room, Mr. Shields' room, and you hear a lot behind what's going on. And Mr. Shields has a friend called Mr. Mulligan, he's kind of involved with things going on outside. I can't spoil anything. It does use Chekhov's gun methods. Chekhov's gun method, in the sense of there is a prop element. Chekhov's gun is, when you've got a gun on the stage, you it's got to be shot at some point. And yeah. Hitchcock plays a lot with that notion, right? So there's object there and there's something's going to be, it's going to be meaningful. It has to be used for something. It's used in Psycho, for example, with a suitcase of money at the beginning.
Yes.
But Chekhov started this, and Sean O'Casey, don't get me wrong, he's a very well-read, very, I think, an intellectual, but very much self-made intellectual, very typical of Ireland at the time. And so very much there is a suitcase in the play. So Mr. Mulligan leaves a suitcase behind. He just comes in to visit, says he can't come. He was going to do something with Mr. Shields, something related to work, and he just has to go. And then it turns out that he's killed, and it's on the newspaper, and everyone just forgets about that suitcase in the room. And that's very relevant because people start to believe that the poet living with Mr. Shields is involved with the IRA, so the Irish Republican Army.
Right.
And he kind of plays along with it because a certain attractive woman called Minnie Powell seems to find it very romantic and exciting that he might be in the IRA, and he doesn't admit it ever, but he's kind of playing along, just flirting away, which and people from the building asking for favors, and he's just kind of playing along with it to humor Minnie, which I'm afraid leads to some dire consequences when the Black Tans, basically the, let's say Black Tans, for those who don't know, is the name given to the basically British police, just making sure that British police, making sure that everything's in order in Ireland, and they're considered very vicious because they also did kill a lot of innocent Irish people. So it's mentioned in a lot of Irish folk songs. Not a nice thing to call them, but I suppose Black and Tans because they wore black and khaki colored clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so it is very much about that. It becomes very violent, the second act, of course, when these two guys and the whole building actually becomes, let's say, attacked by Black and Tan, looking for RA soldiers. And yes, tragedy strikes in very dire consequences. And the whole Dublin trilogy is really tragic. It's just Dublin during the Civil War and just after. And it's quite cynical, actually. So it's really cynical. The characters are described. I think James Joyce, I don't feel like James Joyce really had that much love of Irish culture. He made a lot of fun of it. I think Sean O'Casey did have, let's say, too much love. So he's not making fun of these people that often seem very, very vulgar. But I think he's just making a point that, well, it's very sad that these lovely people turn out this vulgar because of poverty, because of repression. And this theme continues on with the next play, Juno and the Peacock. Peacock being the Irish pronunciation of peacock. Juno is a woman who has to deal with her husband, who's a peacock. He keeps kind of showing off around town. He's a drunk, really. Pretends to be a soldier, pretends to be a bit of a Ishmael kind of figure, a bit of a captain. And he just drove with a boat from Dublin to Wales or something ridiculous. And he's a ridiculous character, Captain Jack Bull, the husband of Juno. And he always walks around with Joxer, who's a man who is kind of like, he just takes advantage of Captain Jack Bull. He just drinks with him, makes sure he gets paid for everything. It's kind of like a leech, parasite-esque character. And it's basically about Juno and her family, and that everyone is suffering because not so clearly the war in this time. It's set during the Irish Civil War, but I don't feel it's as action filled as the previous play. This is more just about simply about the society, and that she's got a drunk husband, a son who was almost killed and who became maimed, and he's now living there, and he's actually like traumatized, and he finds loud noises deeply disturbing, and she's got a daughter who's quite well read, and wants to really move further in life. But she gets manipulated by a seemingly nice gentleman, And it's the irony is the seemingly nice gentleman is actually maybe in some sense the most careless character of all, even though he talks about like being a yogi and being I think he's a pantheist and or he has some kind of different notions. And the point is though, at the end of the first act, the family thinks they're going to earn a lot of money because a cousin is giving his cousins all his money. Because he died. So he's got the cousins giving the cousins the money, and Captain Jack Bauer is delighted. He doesn't wait for the money to come. He just buys as much stuff as possible and says he will give the money back to everyone. Tragedy is, little spoiler, guys, although it might seem obvious as well, the money never comes because literally the cousin did give his money to his cousins, but that meant cousins all over the world, first, second, third removed. So it's a bit of a comedic element. There is more comedy in Juno and the Peacock, although it's also more brutal. Again, the ending, what happens. I can't say much more, except it's again revolves around RA and yes, but also about alcoholism, I find. Not just about the Irish Civil War right now. It's also about just the Irish people having a big, starting to have bad habits, drinking too much, being too military, ever having guns, and all the young men dying. Maybe the woman being too naive and being too attracted to like this lovely gentleman who studies in England. So it is more of a social critical play, whereas the other one is very much it's a bit more action filled, I find. Now I'd love to talk about the next one, but I hadn't finished it yet. So that will be for the next episode, the third part, Blowing the Stars, which so far is even more vicious and a bit hard to read, I find. So right. I'll see if I'm not sure if I'm enjoying it that much, but I do love The Shadow of a Gunman and Juno and the Peacock. They were absolutely wow. Okay. Amazing.
It's not something I would have ever thought to read, so that's an interesting recommendation.
Really powerful, though. Really powerful. Mm-hmm.
Sounds it.
Yeah. Sean O'Casey.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.